We are called to order 805 Community and Regional Affairs Committee. I'd like to welcome to the committee former legislator John Davies. Thank you for being here with the Cold Climate Housing Research Center. John is going to give a presentation today on the center's work. Present, though, before we get started is Representative Sadler, Osterman, Gardner, and myself, Chair Munoz. And I want to thank Butch Carver for recording the minutes. Thank you, Butch, and the staff here today for your assistance. So let's get started. John, please come forward.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I appreciate you having taken some time out of your schedule to hear an overview of what we're doing. Before I get started, I'd like to extend an invitation to each of you who hasn't had a chance to come up. If you get a chance, you're coming through Fairbanks, to come tour our building, which is in the picture up there on the first slide. That's really the best way to get a sense of what we're about and what kinds of the multiplicity of activities that we're involved in, and talk to the people there that are doing the work, because they have the passion and they're the ones that are on the ground doing the work. So if you get a chance, I would commend that to you.
Okay.
With your permission, I'll just get started. Yes. Then with the we're going to just do a quick overview, and I'm going to take a couple minutes to set the scene. Of course, Alaska, like the rest of the United States and the rest of the world, is facing a diverse set of challenges right now. We have a lot of global issues that impact us locally, and we have to figure out what we can do locally to deal with those issues and solve our problems so our children and their grandchildren can continue to thrive in this country. But also, we hope that in doing that, that we can set some examples and find some solutions that will be useful for the rest of the circumpolar north and the world. So there are issues of climate that are impacting us. There are issues of global energy supplies. We see the situation with Libya right now with the security issues around energy. There's a lot of issues. We need to, I think, spend a lot of time looking how we can solve those problems here. And the Cold Climate Housing Research Center is trying to work on one piece of that. We're not going to solve all the world's problems, obviously, but we're focusing on the housing part, the shelter part. People are concerned about water, food, shelter. We look at the shelter piece, but we try to think of it in the context of all those other problems that we're dealing with as well. We're a private nonprofit. We were founded in 1999, so we're fairly new a bit. We were primarily founded by members of the Alaska State Home Builders Association and other people involved in the building industry in Alaska, bankers and real estate agents and folks like that that have been on our board and involved with our formation and continue to be on our board and involved. One of their concerns at the time we were formed was that there was very little research that was being done in Alaska for Alaska. We were relying on work that was done in the lower 48 or in Canada, and oftentimes we were seeing that really didn't apply here. And so because we have different circumstances, fairly extreme temperatures, extreme weather, the west coast of Alaska, the southeast are quite different climate zones. And we needed to try to look at our circumstances and get some research that applied here in Alaska. So that was really what was the driving force behind CCHRC being formed. Jack Hebert was a member of the Alaska State Home Builders Association at the time. He was and is the chief visionary for CCHRC. He continues to be our president and CEO, and certainly is the driving force. If you've ever spent much time with Jack, he has more energy than any six people I know, and he's quite a visionary, but one who also straps on the hammer every once in a while. You'll see some pictures here that he just gets out there in the trenches with people and helps make things happen too. So he's a unique individual, and we're lucky to have him driving this organization and working for a number of people here in the state. Our mission is to promote and advance the development of healthy, durable shelter for Alaskans and other circumpolar people that are similarly situated to us. We're a 501c3 nonprofit. We have 11-member board of directors that's mostly from all over Alaska. Alan Wilson, you know, from Juneau here is our chair right now. And there are members from Ketchikan, from the region around Ketchikan, out west. There are bankers. There are professional engineers, builders, a fairly wide, but all people that are concerned about the building industry. So that's really, that's where our roots are, is in that industry. We have about 40 active projects going on right now in a variety, and I'll go over a few of those with you in a minute. We are fairly diversely funded. Our primary funding is through the state of Alaska funds, but we also have federal funds, local funds, and private funds from foundations.
Excuse me, John, we have a question, Representative Austin.
Sure. You mean me interrupting in a minute?
No, not at all. And I would just say, just generally, yeah. Madam Chair, we've got a bit of time to deal with this, so I'm happy to take questions as we go. So thank you.
Great. Go ahead.
Just kind of on a percentage basis, how do you break down your financing? I mean, like from state, federal?
You know, I don't remember the exact numbers, but if you look in that handout that I gave you, there's a pie chart in there. Yeah. It's about 40, don't quote me on this, but it's about 40% state, 35% federal.
All right, that's good.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah, I should have put a little pie chart right in this graph, in this slide here, but I didn't quite have time to get to that point. So, but it is in that handout I gave you. So our approach, we are based in Fairbanks, but we consider ourselves a statewide organization. We've done a lot of research in all parts of the state. We've had a lot of active projects in Southeast. We've sort of shifted away from that right at the moment, and are focusing more in northern and western Alaska because that's where the really big challenges are right at the moment. But we also work in Anchorage and Fairbanks, and so both rural and urban and around. But our basic approach everywhere is the same. We seek out ideas. We don't claim to have all the great ideas. We look around, and if anybody's got a great idea, we're happy to work on it. We seek partnerships. We try to work with other groups, other individuals, other organizations, other states, and even other countries. And then when it looks like it's time to do something together, we form projects in which we have budgets and timelines and deadlines and deliverables, and we try to produce results from those projects, and then we try to communicate those results to the appropriate people, and you'll see we have a fairly large emphasis on education and outreach. And we hope through that communication and that education and outreach to change things. That's really, if we're not actually causing change to happen, then we're not doing our job, mm-hmm. because that's why we came to be in existence in the first place, is because we saw that things weren't the way we thought they should be. So that's our approach. We have, in 2006, we moved into this facility in Fairbanks. It's 15,000 square feet research and testing facility. It's an example of how we try to do things. It is an example of a kind of a building that we think people ought to be building. In fact, nowadays, I think even it's a little modest in its goals. But it uses 50% less energy than a comparable building. Mm. We've documented that. It was built less per square foot than comparable buildings in the Fairbanks market. It was built to the highest LEED standard. We just recently, in December, received a LEED Platinum certification for the building. So there were lots of concerns about the environment, the green footprint of the building in its construction and the way it's operated. We continue to monitor how the building is doing. It's a research project in itself. We have over 1,200, probably more than that now, sensors throughout the building and the ground underneath it. We clear down, it's built on permafrost, actually. So it's the permafrost is 20 to 30 feet below the building. We have sensors that go clear down from the foundation into the permafrost so we can monitor what's going on there. So far, not much, thankfully. But we measure CO2 in the meeting rooms. We measure the moisture in the walls. We measure temperatures all over the building. So it's like we measure the amount of fuel that our boilers are using, a variety of different things. We have a green roof on the building. We monitor the water flow in and out of that green roof, for example. So it's a demonstration project, and as you'll see, too, we have tours, and we think it's important for people to, as I like to say, kick the tires. And we need to have people be able to come see it, open the door, slam the door, see how things work, get a sense in their mind, a visual picture of how things might work. And so, again, that's an exemplar of the overall way that we work, is we try to produce demonstration, concrete examples of what people can do to use less energy, to be more efficient, to change fuels that they're using, that sort of thing. We have five main program areas. We do a variety of different things, but we try to group them into these things. So we have applied research and product testing, which really almost ought to be two separate areas themselves, but we're small enough that we can't really have too many departments. Incident, we have about 20, a little over 20 employees, so just to give you a sense of the size of our group. We deal with policy information, the kind of presentation I'm giving right now. We try to work on energy bills that are in the legislature. We've spent a lot of time, for example, on Senate Bill 220, the last session, and House Bill 306, working with the staff developing those bills. We have a
John, on that point, are there issues that you're tracking this session? Legislation?
Actually, this session, we aren't heavily involved in the actual bills going through. What we're focused on right now is an update of the policy report that we wrote in 2008. And we hope to be able to present that in an interim form before the end of this session, just so you'll have it, the basic ideas. But we're going to expand that work to transportation energy efficiency over the summer and do a final report that we'll present to you in December. So you'll have that for work in the next session. So just more work on trying to identify the best practices in energy efficiency. We are also having a fairly major focus on RCA issues, the electrical mm-hmm. side of things, too. So we hope to have some good information for you to think about and to use in the next session. But we'd like to give you a heads up on what's coming in a week or two. So that's what we're working on right now in that context. We also have a fairly large effort right now in a program area that we call Sustainable Northern Communities, and this is where we go out and work with the community, find out what they want, and then help them design that, and then even get, as I said, sometimes we get down on the ground and help them get started on building the first one, the prototype, and see how it works, and then we monitor that, try to learn from it, and then hopefully the people there then can take those lessons and those examples and run with them. We do a little bit of work on, we're not really in energy. We work mostly on the demand side, reducing, you know, mostly on energy efficiency, not so much in energy supply. But we do, if it relates to a residential scale energy supply, we do spend some time looking at that. So things like solar panels, PV, you know, both solar thermal and photoelectric, and ground source heat pumps, small scale windmills, you know, off-grid sites, those kinds of things that we've been working with that, monitoring some of those installations, trying to see how they work. And then lastly, we have a fairly significant effort, education outreach. We do newsletters. We have a website. We do courses and conferences, and I'll give you some more information about that as we go here. So let's just march through those program areas, just give you a flavor for what we're actually doing. So in the area of applied research, this is a list, you know, I don't expect you to read it all, but just to give you a sense of the number of projects that are going on, and I'll talk about a couple of these here next. So one of the areas that we focused on in applied research, actually, and it's a really good example, was the exterior insulation, the exterior wall. And we actually, this is the one of the projects that we started here in Juneau with Markham George here, and at the construction technology at the university here in Southeast. And it's not a unique idea to us, but it's an idea that we took and tried to make work in Alaska. And the idea is to put most of your insulation on the outside of your wall. We and it's, we call it the remote wall. That's an acronym. I won't go into what it stands for. But it basically, so you build, instead of building a fat wall and put a lot of insulation in the middle of that, you build a skinny wall back to a 2x4 wall, and then you hang a lot of foam insulation on the outside. And it can be other kinds of insulation, but the way that we did that initially was several layers of foam. So we're putting the bulk of the insulation, 2/3 of the insulation value, on the outside of that 2x4 wall. And that has a number of advantages. It reduces the potential for condensation in the wall because the wall is now warm. It's like a piece of furniture in the room. It has that kind of temperature humidity conditions. So we don't get mold and mildew growing. It also allows you to build the building very tight so that the building is almost as close as you can get to really being airtight, which is good from an energy point of view. It's not good if you're breathing then, so you obviously have to ventilate at the same time. So the mantra that we follow is build tight, ventilate right. So you've got to do both. Otherwise, you'll have condensation on the inside of the building, which is not good either. But so we looked at that. We worked with Mark and Klinkit Haida down here, built a number of their buildings using that techniques, individual single-family homes and multifamily apartment buildings. There are a number of places around Southeast that have taken that example and gone with it. We had a mobile test lab down here on the docks for at the UAS facility down there for about, I guess it was at least 5 years, where we were testing those a number of different wall types and comparing them to that. And it was clear that that wall performed much better than all the other conventional walls that were being used. So that's an example of the kind of research effort that we go. We get an idea, we test it, and we put it into houses and see how it works, and then we refine it, and we're still refining it. But that's one area.
Yes, go ahead.
Through the chair, Representative.
Through the chair, Mr. Davis. The pictures, there's a picture, I don't know if it's before and after here, or winter, summer. You had the same kind of picture with your headquarters. Is that after modifications have been made? I see some changes, but what's the significance of the two different pictures of the same building?
That was that is actually a project that was done independent of us, except for the fact that we helped them design it and we helped monitor it. This is the Northern Environmental Center in Fairbanks, and you can, if you look closely, you can see that in that light green in the lower picture is actually a stucco on top of foam. So they retrofit this building by adding, I believe it was 4 inches of foam on the outside of an existing building, which is an area of research that we're working on right now. This works really well, again, if you do it right. One of the concerns we have about adding foam to the outside of a building is that you create what we call a double vapor barrier. So if you have an old building that has a vapor barrier on the inside and then you put the foam on the outside, it may trap water in the wall. It turns out that in many circumstances, it doesn't happen, and so we're trying to quantify what those circumstances are. We know, for example, that if you have a really poorly built building and you just put 1 inch of insulation on the outside in Fairbanks in the spring right now, you'll have just lots of liquid water running down the inside of that foam because of the condensation that occurs on it, because it's not enough insulation. So there's an optimum. You need to put enough so that the condensation surface stays warm and doesn't actually form ice during the wintertime. So there's an I think I have a picture in product testing later on of an active research project going on to try to measure those different conditions and just try to actually say, okay, this is how much foam. We know that it can work if you put enough, and we know that it doesn't work if you don't put enough, but we're not quite sure where that boundary line is. And so when we want to try to quantify that. So that's another example of applied research that we're doing on exterior envelope issues.
Representative Osterman.
Thank you. John, the difference in the foam between doing it in Fairbanks versus doing it here in Juneau, for example, I mean, temperature-wise, the radiant of temperatures that we have, is it showing that there's a difference in the amount of foam you would do in a wetter climate like this than there is in a drier, colder fire?
Certainly. We've worked also on model energy codes for the state of Alaska, and when we do that, we divide the state into 4 zones, and those zones are primarily delineated on the basis of heating degree days or how cold it is. And so Southeast is one zone, South Central and the Aleutians is Southeast is Zone 6 on the national scale, and Southeast and the Aleutians Kodiak are Zone 7. Fairbanks, the interior of Western Alaska, are Zone 8, and the North Slope is Zone 9. And those, so we have different insulation standards for each of those zones. And it depends on your microclimate, too. If you live up on a cold mountaintop, you might want to put a little more on, you know, and if you live down on the beach, you might not need quite so much. So it depends on your individual climate, how much insulation makes sense. But what we're finding is that from the way most people do things, there's not, you can't put enough insulation in. I don't know if you noticed the Fairbanks papers for the Sunday and Monday, but there were two very super insulated houses that have, you know, like R60 insulation in the walls. And these are houses that are now using no fossil fuels to heat them in Fairbanks, just solar energy and wood. So the key to that, the first thing that had to be done was to build them a fair amount of insulation and to build them very airtight.
John, if somebody's going to build a home and they wanted to get the latest information you guys are doing, would they go on your website? And
yes, there's. They could do that. They could. We have a email address. It's called askcchrc.org, and you can email us questions. And we have people on staff that try to allocate the question out to the right person and get an answer back. So we do a lot of that. But there is a lot of information that's just available on our website. And those energy standards, incidentally, are the BEES, the Building Energy Efficiency Standard for that Alaska Housing Finance Corporation uses for its construction practices. So if you look on the AHFC website and look up the Building Energy Efficiency Standard, it will give you a good guidance for what those insulation levels ought to be. But keep in mind that a code is always a minimum, and so you can always do better than that.
John, I have a question on this outside insulation.
Mm-hmm.
It says on your slide that it requires more ventilation, active ventilation. Does that ventilation, the energy necessary for that ventilation, still make the project overall more efficient in terms of?
Yes, it is a factor, though. I mean, it does, and it's one of the problems we have in getting people to accept it is because it does require more energy. Fortunately, recently, there have been advances in electric motors, the so-called ECM or electrically commutated motors, that use about a third the energy of a conventional motor. So an old heat recovery ventilator or ventilating system, for example, might have used 100 watts to ventilate an average size house. Now with the new motors, it's down to like 35 watts. So we're making, the technology is making progress to help us with that. But it's just, you know, it's just really important that we have air to, you know, healthy air to breathe, and so that's an expenditure that we have to just set up our belts and say, hey, we got to do that. But it turns out that overall, if you build the wall more efficient, that your net energy, the net energy result is a savings, even though you have to spend a little bit more on the ventilation. Okay. So I think we talked quite a bit about all the vapor barrier issues. Product testing, in addition to just the building systems and the way we build buildings, there are systems that we put in there. We get questions, for example, about, you know, reflective insulation. Does it help to have, you know, a foil coating on it and that kind of. So we've actually done some tests on that. And in most circumstances, because that's a radiative thing, it's reflecting electromagnetic radiation, and it doesn't do any good if it's hidden in the sandwich or inside your wall. So in most circumstances, it doesn't add much. That's what our results show. But there are places where it does work, so you need to understand how the physics of how it works and use it appropriately. We're evaluating other things like different types of windows, different types of window treatments. In this picture here, we're showing a motor-driven shutter on the outside of a building. One of the problems with shutters and insulation is if you put it on the inside and you don't do it right, you're likely to make the window cold enough that you get condensation on the window. So generally speaking, the shuttering works better if you do it on the outside, but of course, then there's problems about how do you get to the window and do you want to get out there when it's cold and do it. So having one that would be motor-driven would be a good thing. So we're testing to see just some ones that are commercially available, how effective they are, and do they continue to work when it's 40 below and things like that, so which most manufacturers in the United States aren't concerned about. So we are. So we're looking at a whole range of those kinds of issues. My focus these days is on this area, the policy and information. As I mentioned before, we worked on it. In 2008, we developed an Alaska Energy Efficiency Policy Report that my evaluation right now is that the legislature has probably implemented over two-thirds of the recommendations in that report. So we're very pleased about that. We also work on ACWARM. There's one of the items up there says ACWARM, and I just want to tell you what ACWARM is. It's a piece of software that's been developed here in Alaska. Alaska Housing Finance Corporation has the responsibility for it, and they have delegated that to us right now to maintain and upgrade that. It's the workhorse software that energy raters use when they come and they do a rating of your home. So that's how they do the star rating or the home energy rating for the home, the HER rating, the HER rating. And it allows a rater to look at the insulation you have, look at the kind of heating system you have, look at the type of windows you've got, how tight the building is. They do a blower door test. They get information about how leaky the building is. Put all that into this computer program, and then it calculates how much energy is being used and where it's being lost through the house, what systems would then make sense to fix. And so it's been a very important piece of software. We've recently upgraded it so that it puts out more useful reports for the raters so they can give more useful reports to their clients. And we're also expanding it so it can be used on small to mid-sized commercial buildings, too. Before this, it was purely a residential tool. Now we hope to be able to use it on simple commercial buildings. And let's see what else about it. We're also going to expand it. One of the other areas that's listed on this list is so-called six-star green. The star program now goes to five-star plus. That's sort of the highest. Well, that's sort of an ordinary house these days. And so we want to give people a higher bar to reach for. And so we're going to be developing a six-star and then probably seven and eight. And maybe we haven't figured this out entirely yet, but probably something like a nine-star would be a zero-energy home, one that has no added exterior energy coming into it other than what it collects on-site. And that, like I said, there are two examples in Fairbanks to show that's completely doable. It's not cheap at this point, so we have a lot of work to do to figure out where the trade-offs are and what's cost-effective now, but it certainly is possible technologically. And so we're working on standards for that and how to measure and evaluate those things. And we also have a fairly major contract with Alaska Housing Finance Corporation to monitor the weatherization and energy rebate programs to see how they're doing. And so the data that they're reporting to you is data that we give to them from the database that we're creating. And as you've probably heard from Dan Fasky and John Anderson and others at HFC, that program's doing very well. Both the weatherization and the rebate program are achieving about 30% energy efficiency savings. So people's energy bills are 30% less after they finish the work than before they started. And that's good. It could be better. On a national scale, the weatherization program was doing about 23%, so we're doing quite a bit better than had been done heretofore, but we need to do better. That was an average, obviously, so there are a lot of people that are doing 50% energy savings. The other good thing that came out of the program that we can see in the database is that people are putting their own money into this. So while they, on average, are getting about a little over a $6,000 rebate from the state to help out with the work that they're doing, they're also putting an additional little over $4,000 of their own money into it. So each individual home is getting a treatment that is on the order of $10,000. So that's really good news to see that people are participating that much. One of the early findings, and it will be in our report, and we'll be talking to you more about it, though, is that we're finding that there are middle-income people that are just above qualifying for the weatherization, but who don't, who are not continuing with the program because they don't have enough money to front the work that needs to be done. And typically, those people tend to live in houses that need more work, too, so that it's sort of a double whammy. So that's another an area, a policy area that we need to think about is how we can make it easier for those folks to avail themselves of the program. So I've talked about ACWARM and ARIS. ARIS is this database system that I just described. ACWARM is the software program. Six Star Green, energy policy, and I think we've talked about all of that. So let's go on to sustainable northern communities. As I said in my preamble, the biggest crisis, everybody's dealing with energy across the entire state of Alaska and indeed across the United States. But the real crisis places right now, I think for us, are in rural Alaska. Have received requests for help, and when we don't go out there and say we're from the government, we're here to help you, you know, we wait and try to attend meetings and stuff and make our abilities known, and then people invite us to help. And when they do, the first thing we do is listen. I'd like to just use the pictures that you see up there right now are of Anaktuvik. It was the first sort of prototype for this whole effort that we're doing, and this is through TNHA came to us and said, look, this village has been trying to get a house built. They haven't been able to build one for 10 years because the cost, every time they get a quote, the cost is too high. It's more than the money than they have. Anaktuvik is a place that's really off the road system. There's no road there. There's no river there. Everything that of substance has to be flown in or taken in on a snow machine, so it's remote. It's in the Brooks Range. It's cold there. There's not a lot of. It's above tree line. There are not a lot of wood resources. It's a challenging place. The first thing we did was we went up there and we just opened it up to a village, what we call a charrette, just a brainstorming session. We spent 3 days doing that. You know, spaghetti feeds, had people talking, you know, asked them what was it about the existing shelter that they had that they didn't like, and what would they like to have, and we're not talking about Taj Mahal stuff here. We're talking about, you know, a place to skin your caribou and take care of your snow machine and put your kids to bed at night and have a larger meal with your extended family. Those were the kinds of things that came out of these discussions. They wanted a building that was rooted in the ground, not up on stilts. That was a cultural issue. So we took all that kind of information back. We tried, and the information about the site, you know, the indigenous knowledge of the area, which way the winds flew, you know, what were the issues, what people know about how buildings work there now and in the past. They used to have sod huts there, for example, when it was just a transient hunting ground. So we took all that information, took what we knew from modern technology, tried to put it together in a package that would work, took it back to them and said, okay, here's what we're thinking, what do you think? Got more feedback. And then came back, and then we developed this prototype. Now, I want to underscore prototype. This is an experiment. This is not a conventional house. And we intended originally to build this at the University of Alaska Fairbanks site at Tulik Lake, which is just on the north slope of the Brooks Range, so on the north slope. They have a research station there, and we thought, well, it'd be good to build this prototype building there where we could monitor it. When the people in Anaktuvik heard about that, they said, no. Build the prototype up here. We'll live in it, and we'll tell you how it's working. And we thought, okay, that's a good idea. So we changed our plans, and we did that. So this is the first one. And the idea was, how can you build a building in that climate where you have to fly everything in, where typical buildings require 5 Herc loads of materials? We flew this in 1 DC-6, all the materials for this building. It's using, right, there's people living in it now. It's you can see it's bermed. It's got R60 walls, R60 ceiling, R60 floor, just as incredible envelope around it. It's built on a kind of a skeleton, and we foam it in place. So that's how we can get the stuff in the DC-6, because we just fly in the pellets. We don't have to have all the sheets of insulation. We trained trainers, and then the trainers trained students at the college up there, and college students helped build this place. So we're trying to train the local workforce in how to actually do these construction techniques. And then we're looking at the south face of it now. It's bermed around the north and the west and east so that to protect it from the winds, and the berms are designed in such a way that we hope that when the snow does drift, it doesn't close off the south face. So far, so good. It's got, you can see there's solar PV panels on the front of it. There's a wind generator on a pole there behind it. And it's, of course, oriented so it's facing south, so it collects as much energy in this spring and summer as it can. And it's protected from the cold winds that come from the north down off the mountains. It's using a tenth of the amount of energy that a typical building in that town uses. So, it can be done.
That picture shows the foam.
Right.
Is the foam then covered with something?
Yeah, think of a rhino liner in your pickup truck bed. That kind of plastic liner it's sprayed on. And it's really durable. It's tough stuff. And then you can paint it whatever color you want. So it's kind of like it's sort of like a stucco on steroids, if you will.
Go ahead. Just out of curiosity, how did they decide who got to live there?
I don't know, actually, but that was their problem, not ours. We tried to listen to the village, and they had, I don't know how they chose, but there were many, many people in the village who wanted to live there, and so it was, I'm sure, a difficult process for them to actually make the decision, but there are people living there now.
Is that village moving forward with additional buildings like this, or...?
Not that village, but TNHA, the housing authority for the North Slope area there, that includes that village, is now doing the same process in six other villages now. So they're working, trying to identify where they want to go, what their actual need is, what is important, what the soil conditions are in their places, and going through this sort of process. And we're helping out a little bit, but we're trying to just let... They now know what the process is, and so now they're carrying it out. We're helping out where we can with technology and maybe monitoring. Well, I want to mention one other thing related to this building, and that was one of the things that we did, too, was we put a experimental sewage treatment plant on the building. So there's an individual sewage treatment plant on this house. It's one of the places where we're struggling with the energy, because those things typically, the ones that they were developed by a company in Fairbanks, Lifewater Engineering, and they have, in the way they are used, typically have a 300-watt fan that runs 24/7 because the biological treatment is an aerobic process. It needs to move air through the treatment plant. But imagine a box about the size that would fit inside the tables here. It's about that size. And it's insulated. And what we did with this building is because it has this fan running all the time and it brings air in, we brought the air into that through the building, so that's the ventilation system for the building as well. But we think that we ought to be thinking about using this type of treatment plant in more places around Western Alaska. I've been in some of the villages where you can hardly get around because of all the sewage treatment, the sewer pipes running around overground. We think that maybe using that kind of plant for clusters of homes, maybe six or eight homes, mm-hmm. that all feed that one plant like that. It's the process is approved by DEC. When the effluent comes out of the other end of the box, you can put it right out on the ground. Mm-hmm. It doesn't need any further treatment, or it's clean at that point. You could probably almost drink it, although you'd want to filter it one more time if you did. that's another example of experimental technology that we put into this building that isn't anywhere else out in rural Alaska right now that we're aware of, but which we think might be a real good solution for the future.
Is, Is that system small? Do we use individual homes?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It was developed for individual homes in Fairbanks that are on permafrost, where you can't, where a conventional septic system won't work. And there's, I don't know, 300 or 400 of them in Fairbanks right now. There's also a different company that makes them in Anchorage, and in Anchorage they have a different, slightly different problem. It's not permafrost, but it's small lot sizes on hills where they're not on the main. So in those cases, they have a similar type. You know, it's a similar biology and technology where they treat their sewage on a small, you know, say 1 acre lot that's on a steep hillside where you couldn't put a conventional septic system in.
Is that on your website?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Anyway, and that's another place where, again, we need, where we're working. We hope with the new motors and with a maybe slightly variation on the scheme of how it works, that we can drive that energy cost down so that it's acceptable. Did you have a question?
Thank you. I was thinking about the city of Dillingham, which has a huge problem with the cost that the DEC is requiring, the federal permit system is requiring them to install sewage treatment. So that's a larger community. Would it make sense for them to maybe do something like that?
Well, we'd like, the short answer is I don't know, but I think it's a really good question.
On Alaska, sorry, not Dillingham.
On Alaska, yeah. Well, I think that we ought to look at that. And like I said, I think, you know, we've visualized clusters of these treatment plants, you know, so that you would find homes that are close enough together that it makes sense to run them like that way. But you can even run them on individual homes, and they're not cheap, but I think I haven't actually done the numbers for a place like Alaska, but we need to look at that. I think that they would certainly be comparable to the existing solutions that we have.
Thank you.
Okay. So I think I've gone over. So we do the community, we do team building, we do these concept develop charrettes, we go back to test the concepts, we develop a prototype, and we document it. And that's kind of what we've done. So you can find information about this process on our website. And we're also happy to do specific presentations on particular projects as well. We try to learn from each other, so we try to get as much knowledge from people that are living in the area as we can. We try to learn from the land, the soil types, the, you know, what's gone before there, what the problems have been, things like drifting, where the snow comes from, what it looks like. You know, we need to think about the nature and the animals that live in the area. How, you know, one of the main lessons from animals in the north that we learn is that retaining heat is what's important. So animals figured that out a long time ago, mm-hmm. that the best bang for your energy buck was to have good insulation. Mm-hmm. And so we're trying to emulate that as well. Lots of things about how the homes were built. You know, when you don't have very much, you have to be efficient. Necessity is the mother of invention. And a lot of indigenous folks had very ingenious ways of surviving in harsh climates, and we can learn a lot from that. And what we hope to do is take that wisdom and combine it with 21st century technology and make an even better solution for all of us in the future with innovative combinations of these things. And in the lower right on this slide is a picture of that sewage treatment plant that went into that building in Anaktuvik.
Madam Chair?
Yes, ma'am. Can I go back up to 23, slide number 23?
Yeah,
no.
23.
I'm looking for this one.
That one, okay.
Yeah, and on the lower right-hand side, the words there are is that a indigenous
mm-hmm.
construction?
Mm-hmm.
And do we know what those words are?
I don't.
But
I'm sure we can tell you.
They're describing the form or the function?
Yeah,
or?
They are, yeah. They're describing the material there. It looks like, you know, one's pointing to sod and one's pointing to a different
wood.
Kind of fill and some wood poles. And
on the lower right, what is that?
The lower left?
Very
in the, no, the oh, in that dark, in that diagram?
Yeah, right. The darker color, the light blue, gray.
Color guard.
Is that a waste thing, a storage? Do we know?
Yeah.
You know, I don't know what that is, actually. Yeah, I'm sorry, I don't know.
Yeah, okay. Thank you.
Have to find out.
Air circulation.
Okay, so let's move on a little bit then. That's so, and we're, as you know, back to, whoops, this one. You can see that we have projects going at Atticusuck, Quinnahock, Point Lay, Matarvik, Barrow, Native Village of Barrow, which is not part of TNHA, Koyukuk, Shaktuluk. There, those are just a few of the projects that are ongoing right now. So the, one of the other program areas is what we call hybrid microenergy. So microenergy means energy systems that are residential scale, and hybrid means that they're, as what it sounds, you know, a collection of different systems. So for example, at the at our research and testing facility in Fairbanks, we have solar PV, we have solar thermal, and we have this wood-fired masonry heater that you see in the center of this picture here. So we try to, we're trying to combine all those sources of energy, and we hope to be able to develop, and we had a fairly large project to try to look at a what we called combined heat and power unit, but the idea was to take wood chips and gasify them, convert, literally make gas, and then run it in a diesel generator and generate electricity. And so in the wintertime, to use solar energy stored in wood to produce both our electricity and heat for the building. That project so far has not been successful. We have not been able to identify a small scale, residential scale, or even village scale system. There are larger scale systems that work, megawatt systems, much larger plants. The technological challenge is in treating the gas, and there are a lot of tars and things that get in there, and if you, and you need to make sure that the gas is not going to gum up the diesel genset. And so far, nobody that we're aware of has a system that's successfully doing that day in and day out over the course of several years. So we're still working on that. But what, so our goal is to try to have a building that, that can generate all of its own energy. There are many buildings. I mean, it's quite possible, as I indicated, to design a building that is thermally off, you know, on its own. And the question now is, can buildings generate their own electricity in a variety of different ways? Some of these ways, like putting up wind for an individual building, putting up solar panels, they work. There's no question the technology is there. They don't work in the wintertime, though, and they don't work when the wind's not blowing. And so the problem is, how do you put all that together in a package that's that works, it's reliable, and it's economic? And that's the holy grail. We're not there yet, but we're pushing that envelope as far as we can.
John, the a lot of discussion over time in reference to photoelectric on the solar panels and the amount of energy that they produce on a cloudy day. Is, I mean, you, the work that you guys have done, what does that really show as far as?
Well, it, I mean, they don't.
I've heard it called passive power, passive.
Well, passive solar is the idea that you orient your building so that you get heat in, and PV is considered more of an active system, even though there's no moving parts in it. But the problem is exactly as you say. There's a technical term called capacity factor, and that's the percentage of electricity or power that a device produces compared to its theoretical maximum. So on, in PV panels, for example, if the sun were to shine 24/7, 365 days a year, it would produce a certain amount of power. The question is, what do they actually produce compared to that theoretical maximum? And the capacity factor for those panels is, in Alaska, is around 10%, depending on if you, for fixed panels, if you have a tracker, and then it's more like 16%. And we have at our RTF, we have both, we have tracking systems that track on two axes. They track vertically and horizontally. So they follow the sun. You get a lot more energy, but they're more expensive. And it turns out it's about a push for when you look at the payback costs. So they cost more. They produce more. They produce about as much more as they cost more. But they work, and they produce. And if you had, for example, if you had a tourism business, you know, where you were having to do laundry and you were working, you know, May to September, it would be a great fit. So it just depends on your application. It can be part of a solution. You know, it can be part. I think we're going to get to it. Let me defer part of that question to another example I want to come to.
Okay, go ahead, and then Representative Gardner.
While we're on this slide, this Anaktuvik Pass home has an efficient wood stove. Where does the wood come from?
Yeah.
They have willow, and this is a stove that's designed to use these small sticks, and it's really a backup. It's really most of the time they're heating with a small Toyo type stove.
Thank you.
So that's where I said, you know, it's using 10%. It's 10% of the fuel that people would normally use.
And is the foundation here concrete foundation that you're putting up?
No, it's built right on the ground, and it's a foam pad. Oh, this is the one. So we're one of the. We get probably just about every week we get a call to our offices asking about ground source heat pumps. You know, people have heard about them. You know, there are people selling them in the state. You know, they want to know, do they work? And we say, well, they're a proven technology. People have put them in, but we don't know if they work or not because nobody has ever monitored one of these things for more than about a year. Or two at the most. So the short answer is we really just don't know. So we're working with ASEP, Alaska Center and Power, on a project. First place to do a massive literature search and to try to identify all the projects that have been put in Alaska. And it's surprising. There's over 80. There's probably over 100 installations of one type or another around the state of Alaska. But so far we don't have much data. We have a little bit here and there, smattering. We're trying to assemble all that. One of the concerns is, in a totally heating climate, which we are, where it's cold most of the time, you're worried about heating and you're not worried about cooling that much. Is if you keep taking energy out of the ground, do you create permafrost there? Do you create a frost heave problem? Do you create changes in soil conductivity that degrade the performance of the system? We don't know the answers to those questions over time. But it's clear that the fundamental concern and the issue that would drive all of that is if you're making the ground colder. So one potential solution to that is to heat the ground in the summertime and then take the heat back out in the wintertime. So we're doing a project like that at Weller School in Fairbanks. It's an elementary school that's up in the hills a little bit, so there's no the groundwater table is lower, which is not normally a good thing because you want fairly high conductivity in the ground to couple to the pipes that are in the ground. You can see in this lower left in the picture there that there's that sort of spiral of pipes. That's the system, the system that couples to the ground. So you run a fluid through that and collect heat in it, and then use the heat pump to take the heat out of it, and then you pump colder fluid back in the ground and heat it back up again. So that's how it works. So sort of like a reverse refrigerator.
Representative Gardner.
Thank you. Madam Chair, you might be able to confirm this. Doesn't the Juneau Airport mm-hmm. now use this?
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah, they have a huge installation there, but it's relatively new, and so it's in the category of it's in there, but we don't have much data yet about how it's working. We are very hopeful that we'll get lots of information from there because there's a lot of systems. And these are, well, they're boring. Systems that are bored straight down, and so they go down. They're U-tubes in the well, so they go down and come back up in the 200-foot deep well, and that's that sort of thing. So many people were interested in getting the data from those systems because that is more likely what most people could retrofit in a house. Most people can't dig up the whole yard to put in these coil slinky systems. So yeah, we're anxiously waiting the data from those systems. But again, you know, that's Juneau. It's close to tidewater. There's a lot of Alaska that isn't in that climate circumstance. So we need to get. So anyway, so at this Weller School project, we're putting in a small system. It's not enough to heat the whole school or anything. It's a 5-ton system in the. So it's about a small residential size, but we're also putting in solar thermal collectors on the roof, and in the summertime we'll collect heat in those solar thermal and pump it into the ground back through the same loops. How are we doing for time here? I guess we should quit pretty quick. We're getting almost there. So that would you know, what that would do is store energy collected in the summertime, and then you'd have to use a little bit of electricity to collect that back in the wintertime. A good heat pump system will have what's called a coefficient of performance of at least 3, and what that means is it will move 3 times as much energy out of the ground as it takes electricity to run the pumps. So you put in a third, you get out 1, or put in 1, get out 3 units of energy. And finally, we have a huge effort on education outreach. We had a portal that helped with the energy rebate program. We produce magazine articles, newspaper articles. We do have a weekly newspaper article that we produce. Lots of publications. We have a website. We have a library at our facility that people are welcome. We call it the Builder's Library, where people can just walk in off the street and use the materials there. We don't check things out, but they can use them there. We have a copier in the room so they can copy things. So I commend that to you. Go check on our website. We just upgraded the website. Since we did that, we've had over 6,000 independent accesses of it. We get typically over 1,200 individual people accessing it per year. We do tours of the building every Thursday at 2. It's open for a public tour, and we probably, I don't know what the numbers are there. Again, it's thousands of people that come through there. So again, we're trying to show people, you know, demonstrate what we do, the systems that we have there, all of those systems that are on that building. You can come see how they're working. Okay. So that's it. We are, one last thing, we are building, we have some money from HUD to put an addition on the building, and we hope that will be right now we have people with their desks in the hallways and things. When we designed this building, we had 6 employees, and now we have like 4 times that many. So we need some more space. We also, turns out, need more space for classrooms. Right now, to do larger classes, which we're being asked to do, we're having to do them in our laboratory space, which means that the lab can't do its thing. And so one of the things that can be in this building is a larger classroom so that we can provide trainings and classes. So with that, Madam Chair, I'm finished, and I appreciate your indulgence. And if you have any further questions, I'm happy to answer them.
Thank you. Thank you very much, and really appreciate the presentation. I read about your work and particularly was fascinated about the unique design, the building that you designed. And is it Quinnahock. And that really inspired me to contact you and have this presentation available to all of the other committee members. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
For your work. Are there questions? No. All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Please let us know when you have the policy report together and ready to share it, the updated information.
I'm going to be working with Neil Foster and his committee to see if there's a time when we can present that, or maybe we can do it here. I don't know what the best solution would be, but obviously the pace will continue to get more frenetic down here as
yeah,
we get
and
closer
we
to
could,
the end. So
we could do a joint meeting, too, between
sure,
the two groups.
Sure, we'd be happy to do that. The ideal time from our point of view would be right at the end of the month, you know, early April, earliest April. But maybe offline we can talk about when would be a good time.
Okay, great. And we have talked with members about a trip possibly in the summer up to Galena to look at the school up there.
Mm-hmm.
And so possibly we could tie it in with a trip to your facility. And
we would Like I said, we have an open invitation. We've taken many legislators to the building, and we think it's a good, it's the easiest way to really get a sense of exactly what we're talking about, because we have things that you can touch and feel and look at and see. So we would welcome that.
Okay, thank you.
It'd be more interesting to be able to add it to it.
Yes. Yeah. Boy, that would be fascinating. Yeah. All right.
But it's somebody's home now.
Right.
You can arrange that, right?
Well, I'll try. But anyway, John, thank you very much. Appreciate
Madam Chair,
it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you. And on Tuesday, we're working on a presentation with the state disaster preparedness team, local response teams, as well as the health and social services, just on general response issues, emergency response, as well as the situation in Japan and how we might prepare Alaskans.
Who has a kit ready at home?
Exactly. All right. Thank you very much. Thank you.